This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, August 3rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last Friday, North Korea tested an intercontinental ballistic missile that appeared capable of reaching the United States. The immediate response from the administration was mixed. President Trump attacked China for its failure to keep Kim Jong-un in line, and Vice President Pence told reporters that there would be no direct talks. But in a rare press conference at the State Department, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson offered reassurance as well as a warning to Pyongyang.
We have reaffirmed our position towards North Korea, that what we are doing, we do not seek a regime change. We do not seek the collapse of the regime. We do not seek an accelerated reunification of the peninsula. We do not seek an excuse to send our military north of the 38th parallel. And we're trying to convey to the North Koreans, we are not your enemy, we're not your threat, but you are presenting an unacceptable threat to us.
Evan Osnos joins me to discuss how the Trump administration is facing its greatest foreign policy challenge, a hostile totalitarian regime with nuclear weapons. Evan, welcome.
Thanks, Dorothy.
You've been looking into the North Korea missile tests in recent months. Why have they been accelerating?
Well, they're responding both to changes in the international environment and then also changes in their own leadership. You know, in the international environment, really the change, even though it showed up in the last few months, began a couple years ago. If you talk to North Koreans, they will say quite explicitly that they took a very distinct lesson from the downfall of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. What they saw there was that a guy who had been developing nuclear weapons and then agreed to give them up found himself with no way of defending his government when the United States decided to support an insurrection against him. So that encouraged them to change how they saw nuclear weapons. They had previously thought of nuclear weapons and missiles as a bargaining chip. This was something that they could eventually give away in exchange for valuable things from abroad, aid, assistance, diplomatic recognition. But at a certain point, they decided, no, actually, we may want these as weapons. So they have now tested more missiles in the last 2 years than they had previously in 17 years. So something fundamental changed. And the thing that changed in their own political environment is that they have a new leader. Kim Jong-un came into office in December of 2011 and has been much more aggressive and forthright in developing the nuclear and missile technology than his father and grandfather were. And that's really what led us to this moment.
Is he rational?
Oh, man, that's the big, big question in intelligence and national security circles. Sometimes they'll tell you, I don't know what rational means in this context. But really, if you push people, everybody who works on this seriously will tell you they think Kim Jong-un is rational. He's not crazy. You know, he's kind of got this regime that looks like it's pulled out of a comic book. But the truth is that when we talk about rationality in, you know, in national security, what you really mean is he capable of stewarding his country's national interest? And on some level, he is taking steps that allow him to push back against a much more powerful country, the United States. And that is rational. Now, the one other piece of this that's harder to answer is whether or not the steps that he thinks are protecting himself are in fact hastening a confrontation with a country that he can't ultimately defeat. And that's the real puzzle, is does he realize that?
Well, and of course, the other part of the puzzle is whether our own president is rational, but we don't need to go down that road too far today.
Yeah, the North Koreans, I will say, you know, they ask a lot of the same questions about Donald Trump that we ask about Kim Jong-un. You know, how does he regard escalation of force? Is he prepared to go to war? All of these kinds of things.
Trump's predecessors tried different ways to halt the process. As I recall, Bill Clinton did make a deal in the 90s that pretty much held until Bush came into office. What happened?
This has been the problem that has bedeviled American presidents for a quarter century. And Bill Clinton did sign a deal in 1994. It was called the Agreed Framework. It's now sort of talked about in faintly hallowed terms because that was a deal that would have traded fuel oil and light water reactors, things that don't contribute to weapons technology, in exchange for them slowing down and eventually abandoning their nuclear program. And it broke down partly because there was suspicion on both sides. Neither side was really convinced the other was being an honest participant. There was a lot of resistance in Congress, and the North Koreans cheated on their end of the deal, and it collapsed in 2002. I mean, what's really fascinating, Dorothy, is if you look back at it, the North Koreans will tell you, and the Americans will say the same, that American politics actually shaped this process quite a bit, that if, in fact, Al Gore had been the president rather than George W. Bush, Kim Jong-il said that this might have gone very differently because he thought that he was going to be able to work with a Gore administration in a way that he couldn't with a Bush administration. Is it true? We don't know. But what's important about it is that it shows you that it is possible to strike a deal with North Korea. But when it finally collapsed in 2002, the Bush administration at that point then said, we don't want to make another deal. And they sort of avoided any kind of substantive progress for a little while. But then they started again doing negotiations. That didn't produce a deal.
What leverage does the Trump administration have at this point? I mean, there aren't really any obvious incentives for the North Koreans to give up this program, which they've pursued with such determination.
One of the key questions is, what do they want? Do they want us to recognize them and to open an embassy and begin a normal diplomatic relationship? Or do they actually want to reinvade South Korea? I mean, these are some pretty big questions. And frankly, even the most knowledgeable intelligence figures in the American government who follow this, they will tell you there are big holes in what we know and understand about North Korea. But one thing is clear, and even hawkish American officials will tell you that it's become very clear to them that North Korea really doesn't care that much about negotiating with South Korea. It really doesn't care that much about its relationship with China. This is all about the U.S.-North Korea relationship, because North Korea looks at the United States and it says, you know, we never signed a lasting peace deal from the Korean War. There was an armistice agreement, but we never even officially ended the war. So from North Korea's perspective, this is all about trying to create a new, more stable equilibrium with the United States. How are we going to coexist with this country?
What specific options do we have now? Do sanctions work in North Korea?
So sanctions are certainly the approach that we're trying at the moment. Sanctions have been unsatisfying over the course of the last few years. Basically, they've been able to continue exporting and importing, and they're able to have a level of economic activity that frustrates people who wanted sanctions to work. They actually now have economic growth of about 3.9%, according to the Bank of Korea, which is a remarkable economic pace, considering the range of sanctions that they're under, both from the United States and the UN and so on. But it's worth pointing out that even though sanctions have not worked so far, there is still a credible argument that there are other kinds of sanctions, which we are just beginning to try now, which could in fact work. So it's too soon to say sanctions don't work completely.
What are you talking about, the different kinds of sanctions?
So there are what's known as secondary sanctions, which means that you begin to go after not just the companies that are directly trading with North Korea, but also the banks that support them in China and some of these larger trading conglomerates that play a kind of background role. You're sort of following it up the food chain and you're saying, okay, well, look, we know that there are so many little tiny companies that we can never sanction them fast enough. By the time we get to them, they've changed their names, they've gone into a different business and so on. But what we'll do is go after these larger companies and hit a little closer to the bone. And that there was a lot of ambivalence about it because the Chinese government obviously doesn't want us to do it. They don't like the United States going into the Chinese economy and essentially meddling there by going after Chinese companies. But the U.S. has lost its patience with China on this and has started to say, well, if you're not going to go after the small companies, then we're going to make a more assertive effort to try to go after these larger companies.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Since taking office, Trump has often said that China should be doing more to check Kim Jong-un's behavior. You've lived in China for over a decade, and you know that regime well. What is Xi Jinping's position toward Kim Jong-un?
They have this historical bond. You know, they are, after all, two communist countries neighboring each other in Northeast Asia. Both of them were sort of grew out of the Soviet experiment. But actually, there's an incredible degree of tension between the two of them today. Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, has never met Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, which is kind of an amazing fact if you really think about it.
That is amazing.
In fact, we casually assumed for a number of years that China was able to exert enormous leverage over North Korea. They are responsible for at least 85% of North Korea's international trade. So you think to yourself, well, doesn't that mean they can just turn off the faucet? That would bring North Korea into some sort of submission. But what we've discovered is that China is really unwilling to do that because they are genuinely concerned about the level of chaos and disorder that would produce on their border. They don't know what that would do to their own internal politics. You know, would it introduce refugees into the country? Would it cause a lot of political turmoil? And then also, would it allow the United States to expand its position on the Korean Peninsula to the point that we would have U.S. troops pushing north beyond the 38th parallel all the way up to the Chinese border? So these are the kinds of reasons why China is not going to do what Donald Trump imagined it was going to do at the beginning, which was kind of team up with the United States to try to bring North Korea into submission. But I do want to add one thing, Dorothy, which I think is sometimes lost in this, which is encouraging, which is that because North Korea and China have this really toxic relationship, that does create some kind of opportunity. What it does is it means that China is open to having a conversation about what the United States' presence on the Korean Peninsula is going to be in the future. And the U.S. can say, look, we have no interest in trying to take over North Korea. China can say, look, if you're being forthright about that, we will tell you that, you know, we have no interest in supporting North Korea in reinvading South Korea.
So Tillerson was also sending an open signal to China in making that statement.
Absolutely. What he was saying to China was, look, we do not want to go to war with North Korea. That's a lose-lose for everybody. You know, the U.S. is sending a very mixed set of messages right now. You have Donald Trump sometimes tweeting, as he did the other day, that China has done, quote, nothing to help us when it comes to North Korea. And then Tillerson is sitting down saying, no, we are seeking to apply what he calls peaceful pressure to try to bring North Korea to the negotiating table. And I think, Dorothy, that's where we're headed. You know, when you cut through the thicket of all of these different competing options, eventually the United States is going to end up at the negotiating table with North Korea, with or without China there. And the question is what are the terms, what are the conditions, what are the goals of those negotiations? But right now, we are operating in total darkness. Really. I mean, we have no embassy in Pyongyang. We have very limited intelligence assets there. We have a really impoverished understanding of what this country wants and how it's going to seek to achieve that. And that's a dangerous situation for us to be in. And it's a dangerous situation for North Korea and China to be in.
So what do you make of, you know, talk about intelligence assets? We have the CIA in this equation, too. And a few weeks ago, Mike Pompeo said at the Aspen Security Conference, he talked about regime change.
Yeah, he was speaking in a, you know, informal environment, and he said something that really caught the attention of North Korea specialists. He said that the U.S. is seeking to, quote, unquote, separate the leader from that regime. And that obviously suggested to people regime change. It sort of had the aroma of the Iraq experience. Now, since then, others in the U.S. government have said, you know, that's not what we're pursuing. In my interviews with U.S. officials, they've been adamant that they are not pursuing regime change. As one of them said to me, you know, we're not pursuing regime change, and we really aren't. They recognize that if North Korea becomes convinced that the U.S. is really trying to seek an end to Kim Jong-un's regime or his life, that they're going to respond in a frantic way. And that's how you end up with something really disastrous. You know, I spoke to Jim Clapper, who was the director of national intelligence until the end of the Obama administration. And he's had a long-standing involvement in North Korean issues. And what he tells me is that that kind of mixed message is really the most dangerous piece of this. Because, you know, the North Koreans pay very, very close attention to the words that come out of American officials' mouths. And they hear Mike Pompeo saying that they might try to separate Kim Jong-un from his regime. They read Donald Trump's Twitter feed. And then they hear Rex Tillerson taking a much softer line. And they don't know which to believe. Part of the reason to have some kind of negotiation, some kind of diplomatic contact with them, is so that we're speaking with one voice. So even if it doesn't lead to, you know, peace and harmony, at least it consolidates some of this cacophony so that the North Koreans know what we actually want.
If we do want to go to the negotiating table, does the administration have the capability to take that on? Look at the empty State Department.
A number of State Department officials have said to me, we simply don't have the staff right now to be able to do this. You know, there is no assistant secretary for East Asia at the moment. There are a whole number of empty jobs that are really crucial for the kind of day-to-day mechanical work that goes into building these negotiations, to making them productive. And so, you know, the U.S. has a very dedicated diplomat named Joe Yoon, who's tasked with dealing with North Korea, but he and his office is simply not enough. So this is one of the consequences of the paralysis within the Trump administration's approach to the State Department, that they simply don't have the bodies at this point to undertake a major diplomatic initiative. And that gives pause to people who are pushing for negotiation.
Thanks so much, Evan.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dorothy.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer and the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.